Welcome to Speed Change Repeat with Jonathan
and Benjamin
here in Zurich, Switzerland, together with Carlo.
Hi, guys.
Carlo, where are we here? We're at the FIFA Museum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a really nice office, actually. It's the first time for me in Zurich. And I think it's you're a really interesting character that we have today on our show. And actually, the first one that we're having an English interview with, or
okay.
Let's say an English episode with. So this is going to be new as well for us. So, Carlo, who are you? Please tell us a brief story about yourself.
Brief story of my life.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So my background, let's start with education. So, well, I was born in Italy, Florence, and my background is in engineering, telecommunication engineering and computer science. As soon as I graduated from college, I just wanted to go and work. I work in a pharma company, was local in Florence, was called Menarini. I was doing mostly system engineering tasks. You know, I'm kind of old, so there were the age where the internet were like picking up. You guys probably weren't born yet, so I was doing a lot of, you know, integration of the system point of view of the different companies that the headquarter was acquiring, but at the same time setting up the infrastructure and the strategy to have a presence on the web, you know. And then, you know, this strange, again, wave of hype around the dot-com bubble hit Italy as well, was around, you know, the end of the 90s. And so I joined a startup in Milan, in northern Italy. Mm-hmm. There was a startup, of e-commerce startup that was backed by Deutsche Morgan, Grenfell, in Deutsche Bank, and BCG.
Wow.
And we were selling accessories and motorbikes. So it was an e-commerce site. It was called Motoride. And so I was the CTO there. We started with the three people, you know, the CEO, me, and a bunch of guys from BCG. And I had a lot of fun in two crazy years. I haven't seen that kind of crazy excitement about, you know, technology like in those years, you know. A lot of money, a lot of effort, and like 99.9% of the endeavors of the day, you know, at some point everything stopped and, you know, didn't go through. So it was probably around 2001 that I, you know, had to decide what I want to go next. And I, you know, after 2 years of a startup, I had the chance to go back to the corporate world doing more, you know, system integration, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, my old job, still on, you know, IT / you know, web space, but I decided instead to join to start up the Technology Transfer Center at University of Florence, because they were looking to set up this center that would have helped to turn the research into products. So mm-hmm. I started working there, and mostly was, you know, again, setting up a space, hiring people, you know, kind of, you know, entrepreneur stuff that you do, but, you know, with the, you know, one leg on the research world and the other one on the actual business world. And when I was there, I got interested with the whole new trends that was going on about, you know, pattern recognition and semantic web and structured information on the web. So I decided to start my PhD while I was working. Of course, you know, my boss wasn't happy. He wanted me to mostly focus on my job, but I did it. And I spent 1 year at HP Labs in Bristol to do mm-hmm. my research, where actually my research was about how do we use structure or knowledge representation languages to understand what's going on in images and video. You know, early stage, not that so early, but what will have become later on the whole new, you know, machine learning, data science and AI hype, you know, same principles, you know, there. When I finished my PhD, I got offered a position of, you know, researcher's position. But honestly, you know, I didn't have the classic academic path. You know, I do my master's degrees, then my PhD. You know, I already worked many years. And mm-hmm. actually, you know, what I was doing my PhD was kind of working in the real world. So I said, okay, I just wanted to stay here for 3 years and not understand if I really want to do this. And I took a postdoc position, so going a little bit backwards, in Vancouver, BC, Canada, when oh, wow. I worked on e-learning and all the techniques that I found. Then I got another postdoc in Los Angeles, where I actually spent my last year of university back in the day doing, again, research on knowledge representation of languages, I mean, representation of complex events in reservoir management. So it was a research funded by Chevron. And that was 2008, and you guys remember what happened then, right? You know, a little other bubble that actually crashed most of the market, and the only profitable company in the world was the company that was funding my research, but they decided, of course, to shut down the fund. And so there I am, you know, with the J1 visa in US with a prospect of a month to find a job. The only thing that I could do was to apply for American citizenship, because until you get the answer, you can stay in the country. I applied for citizenship. I did, you know, a bunch of consulting job, and then I landed a job Oregon Health and Science University in Oregon, Portland, when they were studying at the Department of Medical Informatics. And I started working there. I stayed there for more than four years, working on, again, a little bit of research, you know, so trying to understand how we can apply, you know, that we say data mining, data analytics techniques on genomics data. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you know, trying to understand and mining electronic medical records that, you know, try to understand in particular what are the expertise that actually we have in our hospital, trying to analyze what kind of procedures, you know, all the practitioner and physicians and doctors at the hospital were performing. Then another big wave of change hit the world, and was all the new hype about, you know, there was about, I think, 2011, 2012, the whole new data science hype hit the ground. And, you know, and I was thinking, gosh, you know, I'm here working with huge amount of data, which is genomic data, doing most of the stuff. But, you know, I'm a little bit north of San Francisco with all the things are happening. So what I decided to do was to take a leave of absence, join one of, you know, this kind of totally West Coasty San Francisco things, like a boot camp on data science, where you go there. They throw you in a room for 3 months with startups and other people just to try to solve problems. And I think I want to get my feet wet again on what is the latest and greatest in technology and what are the trends are going. So I spent 3 months there. After the end, I had three choices. One was to go back to my previous job in Oregon. The other one that, you know, I got actually a job at Stanford. To do the same kind of medical, still in the research / medical field, doing kind of the same thing, but at Stanford. But then, you know, I kind of by chance applied a job at Tesla, and I got the job at Tesla. So the thing was, okay, Tesla to Stanford, I can always do Stanford to Tesla. No, and so I decided to go to Tesla.
Why did you decide to apply for Tesla?
Because that's the thing. After 3 months in San Francisco, I realized that, you know, the big money and the big opportunities of actually see how much data science or, you know, data can impact where in the industry. So I was kind of in between a research. So my idea is, okay, if I want to actually see, you know, the latest and greatest of what's going on, probably I have to be in the industry at this time at least. So that was my, you know, decision. And also, you know, as I said, you know, probably you can always go back if you want to university, but if you go into a path, you know, for too many years in academia, then it's hard to jump back. And I already had this jump like 2 times, so, you know, you can't do it like forever. So, and also Tesla is Tesla, you know, and, you know, the first thing you said in the when I knew after when I was actually interviewing people how the hiring process at Tesla was, I thought, okay, something got it wrong, because how can they possibly hire me? You know, you feel like classic imposter syndrome, right? You know, say, okay, what's going on? So I went there, and that was great, because I started the data science team within, at the time, Tesla had like three main organizations. One was the manufacturing part. The other one was more, you know, like service and all the distribution cars, and the central one was the product excellence team, was responsible, you know, like how customers like are enjoying the cars. Mm-hmm. And it had a lot to do with the reliability and issue and prevent, you know, bad experience. So our team was responsible to getting all the data out of the more than the thousands of sensors that is in one single Tesla car, and trying to find solution for problems, meaning, you know, if something happens, let's say a battery just got stuck and, you know, doesn't work, how can we build models that predict what kind of, if any other cars in the next future is likely to experience the same problem, and how can we either do the over-the-air software update, because, you know, a Tesla car is like an iPhone. You can just push the latest software update and fix the problem, or call the customer into service to prevent the worst experience ever, which is, you know, to get stuck on the side of the road with your car. Yeah. But by doing this, which was the main task, we became expert of everything that had to do with, you know, how data and cars. So all the question, how is driving behavior in North America different from Europe? Or where should we build our next supercharger in Europe? Or, you know, are we having door handle issues in Norway? You know, all this kind of question, you know, we were the team who was like, you know, answering to that. So, sorry, I just keep talking, and yeah, probably you just
no, no, it's but this really is interesting.
Yeah, so because yes, by now probably the listeners say, okay, these guys have been all over the place, which is true, you know, and you know, I've been all over the place. But so after almost 2 years there, I got a call from Spencer Stewart. So the
Carlo, can I interrupt you here at the second? Sure. So just
yeah, exactly. So interrupt me, because otherwise I keep going.
The thing is, you know, because it's really interesting. That's why, like, you're just like, just listening, you know, and you forget, okay, actually, you know, we could ask some more questions.
Yeah, we can always go back. You know,
but just remember where we left off. But what I want to go more in depth into basically how you started at Tesla, and then maybe a little bit more into actual the tasks that you did there.
Yep.
So was it from the beginning clear that you are going to be building up a team there?
Yes.
Or
so the beginning, they wanted to invest in building a team, particularly of the product excellence, that was, you know, a data science team,
okay,
to solve this kind of issues, and also, you know, be able to navigate the huge amount of data.
But I mean,
so yeah,
the thing is, the team wasn't existing back then, right? So you were responsible.
I was the first hire.
That is crazy.
There was one guy though. There was already the guy dealing with data, was, you know, an engineer by training, but, you know, a mechanical engineer, but was more of a reliability engineer, because some of the stuff that we do was also has to do, like, you know, time to failure and, you know, accelerated tests for reliability. So this guy was the one in charge of that. So had a little bit of skill, and actually was a really bright guy, you know, and the skills of like programming skills, you know, reliability, but was mostly a reliability engineer. So I've been tasked to build a team of people that were, you know, so I start hiring data scientists and data engineers.
Yeah.
And by the time I left, I think we were like seven, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So not a big team.
Yeah.
Also because, you know, Tesla, yes, organized was a kind of a startup. So there were like people, all engineers in the tech company. So people dealing with data and all over the place. The problem, no kind of, you know, organized and, you know, harmonized effort on many things. So a lot of inefficiency even there. So everybody had their own tool, everybody developed their own, you know, code to do mostly the same thing. So was a lot of also work of like, can we harmonize? And of course that's the core infrastructure team that deals with, you know, how do we get the data out from the car? Where do we store it? And by the way, at that time, Tesla had the biggest MySQL cluster in the history of humanity set up, because everything was running on a MySQL cluster.
Oh, wow.
Just as you
That's
know.
Crazy.
That was back, I think, 2012, probably 2013. So, but then we switched, you know, on Hadoop, and I don't know, you know, the system. But, you know, just to give you a sense, you know, there was a lot of moving parts. But, you know, yes, I was tasked to, we want to have a team within the product excellence that actually is able to do data analysis, data science, and, you know,
and that is back in 2012.
11. That was back 2012.
Yeah, I imagine that that team to be grown by now by a
large
number, right?
Yeah, I don't remember, you know, right now, you know, again, Tesla is such a fast growing and changing company, and, you know, I know most of the people that were in my team, they're not anymore there, you know, a lot of changes, but yes, you know, and again, there was a diffuse kind of, you know, data science like teams and stuff, so I don't know the status anymore or what is in there, and I don't even know it, you know, but yeah.
But to go more in depth and with what you actually did, so when you started hiring people and you kind of had a team, was it more or less okay, so we know the problems, right? So there we have the data, we see the problems that we could work, or let's say work solutions out for. Or was it also a lot of, let's say, exploratory analysis, basically?
I think the good part that it was, you know, mostly the issue was, okay, when we have an issue with a car, how can we prevent these issues to happen again to mm-hmm. get the, so the frame, the main task, the frame was clear. You know, it wasn't, you know, oh, we have all this data, we don't know what to do with it, try to look at it. It wasn't that way.
All right.
Which is, you know, I've seen several cases instead of that. You know, oh, yes, everybody's doing data science, we have a bunch of data. Yeah, let's have a data science team and let's expect magic out of it, right? Yeah, no, no. But no, it was a little bit more confined. But of course, you know, it was a lot of, you know, like green field in terms of infrastructure. How do you go about building a team? How do you relate with the other team? And also the most important thing that I've seen over and over again as a key and crucial aspect of every single other job that I had since then is, you know, how do you build a cross-function relationship and, you know, collaboration to deal with complex problems? Because, you know, we were mostly data science people. And one thing that I tell you that is also holds, I try to hire people that are not from the same background, I mean, not all computer scientists, not mm-hmm. all. So I try to put together physicists, computer scientists, computational biologists, people that come from like logic and natural language processing background, the other people, astrophysicists, because it's important even within the same team to have a very, very different angles and views mm-hmm. that if a people trained in the same discipline, they tend to see things on the same, you know, with the same angle. Yeah, yeah. And this is not good for data science at all. No. Also, you know, doing this, you facilitate the integration and collaboration with other companies. For instance, you know, we were all data scientists. Nobody, we couldn't be possible expert of every single part mm-hmm. of the car from, you know, tires, from batteries, from, you know, rear view mirror. So we had to collaborate and in particular put the people that were responsible, for instance, of a single part of the car that was like presenting some things that we wanted to understand in the position to, you know, understand what was going on and explain why we thought a solution was a solution and have them validate it. So this is something that has been called, I did a kind of a interview by, I think it was Forrester at the time. There's also a paper about like system of insight. So how do you quickly, you know, get the right data, get the right people, and get the right insight out of this loop? And the human factor, again, we were talking, I think, before in the interview, is such a key part of the work of a data scientist, not just because, of course, you know, it's always nice to deal with the machine, the problem arises, and the problems arise when you deal with people, but because you have to have people in the loop to get this kind of solution accepted, you know, validated, and actually be effective. Because, right, you know, we were like jumping in a room, stay in a room, try one model, figure out if it worked. And sometimes it was simple things, you know, trying to figure out what was the measurement that if, you know, if it stayed for a long time after the threshold, there was a hint of a trigger for the problem. You know, I'm not talking about like deep neural network, you know, it can be even a simple way of measuring time above a threshold that can be an indicator of a problem. But mm-hmm. in order to, you know, arrive to that conclusion, a lot of interaction has to go. And part of our work was a lot to build tools for people that weren't necessarily data scientists, although technical, to look at the data, to inspect the data, to understand what we were doing. So lots of communication, lots of visual mm-hmm. communication what we were doing, and a lot of, you know, quickly interaction and, you know, build hypotheses, I mean, agree on a hypothesis, test it, and loop again. And that was crucial because, you know, you don't want to wait until, you know, 30 or thousands of cars present this issue. You need, so we had the reverse problem in a sense, you know, yes, huge amount of data for thousands of sensors, but small data in sense of, you know, like occurrences of this thing. So you can wait, you know, until exactly 2 million cars present the problem. Oh yeah, now I have a big data to build my great model. No, you can't do that, right? So just to give you a little bit of sense. So yes, going back to your question, there was actually a scope and a mission for the team, mm-hmm. which was that one. But, you know, a lot of, like, things had to be defined. For instance, from infrastructure point of view, one important problem when it comes to reliability that, you know, from regulators, you have to be able to go back and show, like, for instance, if you calculated a time to failure of a lifetime for a component, what kind of data you use, what kind of software you use. So we had the problem to create snapshot of code and data at the given time and be able to rerun our models and our calculation at that fixed time in order to be able to show, look, this is the conclusions that we came upon. And, you know, if you run your same code 1 year after with a different data set, you get different conclusion, as you probably know. So for instance, I started at the beginning, okay, we should build a system that is, you know, that allows us to do that. So how can we, and you know, we started exploring how can we take the snapshot of the data, put it in MongoDB, blah, blah. And then I discovered, you know, that there are platforms that help you to do that. So now I'm not talking vendors here, so not again, but you know, we were using, you know, like platforms that actually were meant to, you know, deal with reproducibility of, you know, let's call it experiment, but you know, like have snapshot in time of your code and your data so you can reproduce the results. And so we could focus rather than build infrastructure to build actual models and deal with data. So there was a great, great time when, you know, we were building, again, the team, building the tools and building the relationship. You know, there's no other way around these three things. And the most important thing when I say relationship is the social context that allows you to do data science. And this is most of the time really undervalued, I see. And it depends a lot on the company culture. In a company like Tesla, this is kind of comes easier, not at zero cost. You have to put some effort, you have to think about it, you have to establish, you know, how do you go about work. But and another company, maybe, you know, more traditional, if you want, company, this is really something that you have to invest a lot because it doesn't come natural. That's why, you know, the cultural aspect, I always think, is underestimated when you really try to build a capability like, you know, a data science team within a company. That's really huge. And more these days, I think that what I call it, you know, the way in which you're taking decision and the decision-making process is how critical thinking and argumentation plays a huge role is really underestimated. So, you know, that this is the biggest part. You know, even though, you know, we're thinking right now, okay, let's move from data-driven to AI-driven decision-making process, sure. But how do we reach a consensus about one model? How do we evaluate impact and consequences of this? This is a social, or as I call it, you know, an argumentative context that really people aren't trained to, you know, in particular people with technical background, you know, they are not trained to this kind of issues, and with this kind of skills, they're really crucial, you know. So I saw that happening at Tesla. The facilitation at Tesla was that the culture, you know, of collaboration and openness and, you know, let's not blame us for failure was really there from, you know, the DNA of a company. And, you know, so it was easy, but, you know, nevertheless, you have to put a lot of effort on that aspect to have things working or to have an impact. It doesn't, you know, because you can have the greatest model that has like 99.99 accuracy, and if you're the engineer is not convinced of that, that's not going to go in production. No, seriously. So you can put all your technical effort in there, but then, you know, you're stuck because you're not able to show how that thing is reasonable to, you know, the colleagues that have to say, yes, I think this is a good thing. In particular, when you have consequences, like if you put a model in production, if you recall a million car, you have to better think, you know, that you're convinced of the solution you put in there. Still, you know, even more and more when you go in healthcare and you put in production, you know, a model that predicts cancer, you know, look, the degree of consequences or impact, you know, it can be from, oh, well, we've lost like $10,000 because it's A-B testing was poorly designed, to we kill people. So it's really, really interesting that the aspect that, you know, and all the problematics that are involved there, again, have more to do with this social argumentative aspect than the technical one.
True. But, you know, I think actually still, if you take a company like Tesla, right, and I guess the time at Tesla for you, or let's say within the environment of the Silicon Valley was probably very memorizing and very shaping, right?
Yes,
because the culture, or let's say, is really, it's not the same as, let's say, in the rest of the world, kind of, yeah, right? So it's very different. And I assume also when it comes to actually exactly those points that you were talking about, you know, acceptance of, let's say, the model, or let's say the human side of it, I think you still, the DNA of the average employee that you have at Tesla, for example, right, there's a completely different understanding of the, yeah, world, right, and also of technology, yeah, and how technology can be used than, for example, in a traditional company that is within healthcare.
Yeah, you know? It's true. Yeah, that's part of it is true. I think, you know, it also there are many aspects, you know, the culture of the company, also the culture of the country of, you know, that there's a difference. So you are in US, which is already a different approach to, mm-hmm, you know, work and possibility than we have in Europe. Okay, more, I could call it optimistic, more can-do attitude in general, you know. And then, you know, you're within this, which is the first level, you have another level, you're in Silicon Valley, which is, you know, another, you know, exponential, you know, positive attitude towards things. And then, you know, and then you're at Tesla, which is is a mission-driven company. It's not definitely a car company. I think it's totally mission-driven if you know, the Elon plan all along. So, yes, absolutely. You know, there's all this part. But I have to say, you know, that, yes, there are differences between the company I've worked on, but you really have, so the cultural part is important. And you can, for me, for instance, the job after Tesla, I really took it because of the challenge of, you know, wanting to change, because the company, which was Pirelli, by the way, wanted to really change the culture of the company, starting a data-driven culture. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was kind of the other way around. So in Tesla, you have already the culture. How do you put it in use? And Pirelli said, okay, can we create, now it's called digital transformation. You know, when I started in Pirelli back in 2015, that term wasn't so, you know, like the hype that is right now, which, you know, doesn't mean anything anymore. But the idea was, you know, can we change this company by creating a data-driven culture? So, and it was interesting, you know, because, yes, you can see this way, you know, you need some conditions to work with data in a proper way, but also trying to work with data can help you to build the conditions that are needed in order to work with them. So in Pirelli, actually, saw that other angle of the story, you know, in Tesla was, okay, we have this culture that, you know, we can do great things. Can we start working with data and push the cultural change that is needed, trying to work with data in a proper way? In fact, the data science analytics team that, again, I started from scratch in Pirelli was actually the first brick of Pirelli digital transformation, which, you know, those years, Pirelli changed completely, got the listing from the market, then, you know, just focus on be a very high-end, just only tire company, relisting in the market with successful listing. A part of this, you know, strategy of transforming the company was related, you know, to build, you know, the data science team in there and work on a data-driven culture.
I think let's take two steps back. So because don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Don't let me drive. It's very dangerous.
Yeah. So Pirelli was after Tesla.
Yes. So, okay. Yeah. So we were in the story. Yeah. You know, right, had a phone call from Spencer Stewart.
Okay.
Little less than 2 years in Tesla.
Yeah.
I got this. You know, Spencer Stewart. You know, the kind of recruiters that you don't want to say no. I don't care about you. So with no intention to, you know, get into another job because I was really happy and engaged at Tesla. I say, okay, let's talk. And so we start talking, and they didn't mention Pirelli, didn't mention Italy at the time. And by the way, at that stage, I was already a US citizen with no intention to coming back to Europe, let alone Italy. But yeah, and so the story goes, you know, never say never. But anyway, so we started the conversation, and they were actually looking exactly for the position that I discovered a little bit after that was the head of data science analytics at Pirelli within this journey of transformation of the company. But what really convinced me was when I went to the step of interview more out of curiosity than, you know, the real interest. But towards the end, when I was in Milan and I met with the CEO, the whole management team, I really had the sense that how serious they were of, you know, betting on this in terms of, you know, we really want to change this company. We want to change it starting from this part, from this piece, which is creating, using data and creating a data-driven culture.
That is incredible.
Yeah. And so, and I said to myself, damn it, This is, one of the biggest manufacturing company in the world that has this high bet on the things that I like to do with this high stake and challenge, which is, let's change the company. Either I do it or somebody else is going to do it. And so I say, okay, I am up for the challenge. I want to see how is it possible, because I was really interested, to see that other side that I talked about before. And so I took the job. And I always say, Italy, yes, not bad. But if it wasn't Singapore, I would have taken anyway, because, because of the challenge of what interest. But, it didn't hurt that it was in Milan, because, I like the city and everything. But it wasn't driven by, I've been here for 10 years, I want to go back to Europe. No, actually, I was completely against it before that. But I got really interested in the challenge. And I had to say, there was a really nice learning experience, a more structured world, of course, like under plus year old manufacturing company, but really with the will to change. And even that, I even more the human part, or, the interaction on how do you build this relationship and, this context in which you can debate, argue, and, find and show things were really crucial. In particular, it was interesting for me to work with people in the factory, because, one of the big effort that we did was, the smart manufacturing program, or was Industry 4.0, as it's called in Europe. But again, a big label under which you have like everything in RFID, robotics. But again, I decided that for us was important to start from the data, because it's the underlying piece on which all the other technology can build upon. So for me, doing, a nice 3D printing effort of a nice, robotics without the foundation didn't have much sense. So we started to look at, and the other part, the company had a very good manufacturing IT system with a lot of historical data collected. So it was a low-hanging fruit starting from there. And we saw that, for instance, yes, data science, yes, algorithms, cool stuff, but simple visual analytics can impact a lot on the bottom line. Talking about, efficiency. You're a manufacturer, you work in, or you're familiar with the factory world, like efficiency, right? And quality. So with like even the time of reaction, then, if you can just reduce the downtime of a production machine of a small amount, is a huge amount of money. So then you learn, that the impact that data can have doesn't, most of the time, does not necessarily go through the fancier stuff, but can do, you can do a lot of impact with like simple, again, visual analytics. And what we did most of the time was like trying to move towards near to real time visual analytics as possible, rather than, have, okay, this machine failed, let's wait tomorrow to get the data and see why that happened. So delay, reduce this delay, and that very, very interesting part there was to, because the first mistake that we made, we make mistakes, but if you throw out there some solutions and people that have to use it haven't been involved in the design, in the validation properly, you're gonna fail. For instance, imagine a blue collar guy who's been for like 12 years watching the same kind of machine, and he knows it better than their own, like spouses. They know everything about the machine. And then you arrive, the guy was hired like 6 months ago, and tell this guy, hey, you have to do push the button when my algorithm tells you so. What do you think the guy is thinking? You think, yeah, you're nuts. You don't know anything about this machine, dude. I've been here for 12 years. So, the first attempt that we did was really people weren't doing what we were suggesting with this. It was, even a simple thing, like, hey, check this machine because we are detecting a trend, right? Just even simple stuff, this cycle time is going all over. So one very big lesson was how do you involve, people that actually your end users, internal end users, in the design process of your solution. And also we started the greatest impact was, all this training program for blue collars to, and the ability, it was a big change to, to have data available for factory people. Usually data is, the kingdom of traditional organizations and is power. You know, you can't access data. And I decide who can access, and that's why I run the power in my company, right? And that's why I hold my seat and I get my salary, because I have the power and I don't give it to you. You can't know the data that I know otherwise. So, and the big cultural change was actually, no, let's democratize the data. I mean, of course, with security, you know, with everything that needs, but, you know, let's put the people that actually know better the data in the position to actually access it and see them. Because you don't have to turn everybody into data scientists, and it will be a stupid effort, you know.
So how did you actually get this done then? I mean, like, so I guess to get
a grid on this human factor, right?
True, but I guess the idea came from you, or mm-hmm. let's say from your team, basically.
Yes.
And I mean, there's a lot of people that have certain positions, yeah. which are, let's say, probably going to, talk
yes.
against it.
Yes, and again, it depends on each organization, the best way. Again, you know, you have to know the context, so that's part of your job, right? You know, you arrive in a position of, like, head of the data science, you know, the first thing, you know, okay, how is the landscape? How is the lay of the land? What are the issues, but also, you know, what are the people, what are they holding on, like, the mm-hmm. power center? You know, you have to understand that, but you need to have two things. For me, it was a little bit of a mix of going rogue, asking for forgiveness rather than for permission, and have a strong backup from the top.
Yes.
You have to do a little bit of both, because if you wait for the whole chain of command of approval, you may not get there in time. But at the same time, if you don't have it to a certain extent, you can be burned. So it was a little bit of a mix. So and the good part that I think the organization was wise enough not to, at the beginning, we were really kind of a little startup inside the company. So, you know, a lot of freedom, even, you know, from the process point of view, like budget, you know, we redesigned our hiring process. You know, that was a wise move of the organization to not greed this new organization already into the, you know, company rules and processes and stuff, because, you know, you need a little bit of flexibility and speed, in particular at the beginning. And so, you know, if you have this, you can find, you know, ways to do things that are maybe borderline at the beginning, but, you know, then you can show the benefit to have people on board. And of course, as I said, you know, you have to have a work from the bottom up, and from the, you have the approval from top down. You need both. You can't go, and that's another lessons learned. You can't go only with the CEO and board approval. You need to have factory people on your side. Otherwise, you're not going to work. Right?
I guess the hard part is actually not the factory. I mean, yes, of course, that is a change in a change process of let's say convincing people that.
Yes.
Technology literally can help mm-hmm. them, you know, and that, of course, their 12 years of experience is mm-hmm. very valuable, but that technology is there basically to help them, right?
Yeah.
To improve their work, for example.
Yeah.
But I guess the more harder part is, which every company probably has, is let's say the internal politics, right?
Yes.
So, and especially, let's say, middle management or...
Yes. And again, involve them, try to work with them, not just walk mm-hmm. around them, because that doesn't work. And I know it works with somebody, not for everybody. And for me, the thing, you know, try to show something that is different and better. For instance, having, we work on, even now there's a very abused term, but, you know, we use kind of agile approach, which means let's be iterative, but basically let's be transparent and invite everybody, all the stakeholders on, you know, on a review and stuff. So this level of changing the way in which you communicate what you're doing and you show what you're doing, that helped a lot. So for me, it was, let's be open, let's be transparent, let's invite everybody that is interested to show what we do. And so for me, the key is try to show something different and better. Still, people can be against it for many reasons that most of the time may not be reasonable, but you can always bet on the same amount of reasonable and unreasonable people in a sample population going statistics. So if you show that, you can you know, if you're at least, you know, you can't be unlucky like 100% of the time, you know, statistically. So you're gonna get the buy-in eventually. Mm-hmm. But yes, for me, it's like top approval, bottom work with the bottom up approach. Try to show something that is different and better, because if you do the same thing that everybody has been doing, why
can't come with data to you? Back,
yeah.
Right?
I give you data, I don't know what you're doing with it. I'm giving you my data, I don't know what you're doing with it. No. You giving access to this. This is what we're doing. This is the benefit. Look. And also, you know, and you can look at this as well. It's not just for them. It's something for you. So it was also built different level of tooling, you know, mm-hmm. for different level of people organization, because, you know, the people on the factory would needed something, but middle management needed something else. And the CEO needed something else as well. Again, another lessons learned. Data science is not only actually, no, it's not only about, let's say, dealing with data, building models. It's how can we build solutions for people to interact with data at the level in which they need to. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's because the CEO interaction with what your output is very different from the guy in front of the machine. It has to be very different, because if it's the same, you're going to fail in either or both, you know, like audiences or users that you have. So that's one thing. Yeah. So going back, how do you build it? You need to, again, these three things, you know, for me, showing something different and better, have a little bit of a rogue approach, do it, you know, and then ask for forgiveness. Be sure you have a little bit of strong commitment from the top and involve people as much as you can. And again, it varies a lot on the organization, on the time and history of organization, because what works at the beginning, then it doesn't work maybe, you know, a year or 2 years down the road. Mm-hmm. So you need to also be careful of how trends or hype is moving onto different mm-hmm. things in a company, which is always happening, particularly if you're a big company. So, you know, it's a lot of trying to navigate this kind of stuff.
I think it's really interesting that you basically have both worlds, right? You've been in the valley, which is like, let's say, the spot mm-hmm. for people like you, but also you
on the mountain. Yes. Valley at the mountain of corporate mountain corporate.
Yeah, exactly. And you've seen the let's say the old world and have impacted the old old economy, basically. So if there is, or could you basically tell us one moment for each of those. So for your time in the valley at Tesla, it doesn't have to be from work. It can be just a moment from your time there and your time back then when you were at Pirelli. Like one moment for each of those which really, let's say, impacted you or which you still remember, which is kind of insightful, where you say, okay, if I think back to my time, this is what I think. This was crazy.
Crazy in a good way or crazy in a bad way?
No.
Because
let's keep it positive.
Let's keep it positive. Shaping way.
So, I think at Tesla, the defining moment, I think, you know, what we put in production, our first prediction algorithm for an issue that we're having, and it was like, you know, shooting every day the VIN of the cars that we should update or take into service. And that was really an achievement. So from the output of your work, you say, okay, we actually did something. But, you know, there's many little things, in particular Tesla, they were with the part of like building tools that people were using. And so the defining moment probably is there. Yeah, the first time that we had the algorithm running and we figured out that actually the cars they were like, you know, predicting were the right ones was a big moment. That's for sure. The moment back in the more corporate world, I think, was when actually the CEO came to one of our stand-up or, you know, the showcase, a weekly showcase, which is always another building. Usually, you know, everybody goes there. And there was a time when, you know, instead the CEO came to us. So this for me was a defining moment that something was shifting. you know, and so it's more cultural there, because also what that was the challenge. Rather, you know, at Tesla was, you know, the culture was kind of there, you know, how can we make an impact on the actual thing that we do? But, you know, the, one of the goal of Pirelli was, you know, how can we make an impact on the culture? If that for me was, you know, the time when I realized, okay, something actually, you know, has, you know, has changed here. So this is probably the two moments. And yeah, then many times, and then, you know, it's always for me, again, it's always about the team. It's never about me. So in both cases, the amazing time building and nurturing a team of people with which, you know, you're, besides, you know, the geography, and we're still in touch. This is, you know, probably the underlying theme that makes every work experience worth in the end, because it's all about relationship more than what you output, because these are the things that last, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, yeah, that, you know, there are many moments, but, you know, the whole fulfillment as a team of being together, building something together, and, you know, impact together something. This is, you know, there's a many, you know, the whole process for me is a defining moment, even though it's not a moment, because that's really, that lasts, lasts even, you know, doesn't matter if you leave, if people are not there anymore, but, you know, this is actually something that I really value and is really valuable from the human point of view, that lasts more than the algorithm that probably is not used anymore, right? I mean, of course.
Yeah, I get it. I think before we actually go on and then kind of talk about why we're in Zurich, actually, there's one more thing that I kind of wanted to ask you is before you started at Pirelli, did you have the feeling that really the management board, let's say at the executive level, which is guiding the company, building up the vision, really understood what Pirelli needed to do?
I would say that
in terms of, let's say, okay, even though I really hate the term and it has been misused, digital transformation, that they really knew, okay, so we need to change and this is what we need to do, and that's why we need a guy like you.
I think that the CEO had the clearest idea that we need to change, and in order to change, we need to use data in the way we haven't used it before. Basically, we're not using data. That's the key of how we change our culture. He had a really, really clear that vision. Then, you know, the details of how this would unfold, no, but this is not what you're expecting. You know, what you're expecting from, you know, the C level is, okay, we are committed because we believe in this. Then your job, our job, is, you know, to show how, to make them understand what is possible, what is not possible, to manage expectation. But yes, I would say the thing that really actually convinced me was that there was this strong commitment and belief that we need to change. In order to change how we work, we need to start to using the data.
Yeah.
So this was a crystal clear, at least from the CEO.
Yeah.
Then, you know, not shared and understood at the same level with everybody in the matter, but yes, that was crystal clear, and that's the thing that actually convinced me to go there.
I think, and that is also, let's say, a crucial requirement, actually.
Yes,
right,
for success. Yeah, because if you understand that, yeah, we wanna do something with data because everybody's doing it, so please join this company.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna buy it, right? Because you know you're gonna get in trouble the next day, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that they have to understand, you know, what is actually needed. So, you know, it's okay if you have to assess and design a path and solutions, but, you know, the conviction that, you know, we really want to do this because we believe that if we don't do this, we're not gonna be competitive, and we wanna bet on this because this is the key part of how we change how we work in our culture. Yeah, that was clear.
To be honest, I have to challenge you on this one.
Yeah, go.
I think. I mean, yes, of course, they don't really need to understand what actually are, like what is the let's say the hardcore stuff that we're going to do, what kind of models are there, whatever. But I think, and this is the problem with a lot of, let's say, historical companies, is that it stops actually at this point. Yeah, yes, we have to do something. Well, because there's a global awareness that, okay, there's digitalization. But what I think is that actually from the requirement for a management board or for the executive level actually changes in the way that they actually understand the, let's say, on a more broader perspective of, okay, what is this actually? What is happening, right? Sensors, data, what like also in terms of, because those are business people, right? They need to think from a business perspective. And I think that is a crucial point.
Yes, and they have it, but part of a job, if you got hired as, you know, the head of data scientist, provided that you're convinced that the is to have a, you know, a kind of a educational path exactly on that. Because, you know, all the business people, they're business people, and they want to know if the bottom line is growing, they're happy. Then, you know, and they know exactly better than us data scientists or whoever, that what are the pains they're feeling. So yeah, it's all about, it's true. And they may not know, you know, why or what they need, but they know what is not working and they know what they want to get better. And they have kind of a feeling that, you know, there has to be a way with all this information, you know, that we can do better. And that's enough for me, you know, the willingness to try and change, that's enough to open a breach and change it. They don't have to have it all clear, I want to do A, B, C, D, but they have to know what doesn't work and what they would like to, you know, to work. That's it, at least in my experience. Then, you know, I agree with you, you know, it would be part of, you know, for sure, you know, part of the framing the problem, you know, on manufacturing, it was clear, you know, what are the pains and what are the issues. Then, you know, if you want to move towards, you know, have a direct relationship to consumer, that's why you have to use data and how is that. So this was also part that were clear. But yes, I think it's a journey. You know, if there is the acknowledgement, yes, these are the pains. This is, we do really think that, you know, working with information can help us, and probably we are understanding that if we keep working the way we're working right now, we're not going to be competitive. This opens, you know, the bridge to, for you to go in and work and change. So if there is that condition for me, that's enough to infect with something different, like a virus. You have a breakthrough.
A good virus.
Yeah, a good one. Yeah,
a new
yeah.
mindset.
Yeah, exactly.
True. Very interesting. Although now we're in Zurich.
Yes.
we're not in Milan.
No. I stayed there for 3 years and a half, a little bit more probably. And you know, this is a transformation path, you know. Again, I got more and more involved, you know, from the data science. Also, we started a team of digital product development because, again, there's no data science solution that doesn't end up in something that, you know, is a user experience in the end. So it was like a natural segue to expand the team. But then, you know, after 3 years and a half, you know, the path and the strategy was laid down. And, you know, we started to implement it, periodically got released. So it was more like business as usual. And also, you know, the team that was there was strong enough, you know, ready, you know, to keep carry on. And at the same time, I got interested a lot, you know, in how, you know, strategically, again, can we, and culturally, how can, you know, technology affect, again, you know, in broader sense, you know, the change of a mindset of a company. And so, you know, there was this opportunity and here that, you know, I saw that there was this new digital transformation innovation division within FIFA that was starting. And so I got interested and that's why I'm here. I've been here for 6 months. My team, the strategy team, strategy and digital venture, we're actually a team that deals with not only with data or AI, but the whole wide range of technologies that can affect in the future for the better the world of football, in particular the fan experience or, you know, the venue and events experience and so on. So again, you know, there was a step for me to broaden the interest, still with the same, say, point of, you know, how can we, because the mission of this digital transformation innovation, so how can we really transform again this place, you know, and make, you know, make it relevant for the future, you know, in many ways. So for me, it was an interesting segue, you know, having done, you know, the path of digital transformation in a kind of, you know, traditional organization. This is kind of a traditional organization as well, but with the will again, you know, of changing and innovating. And, you know, with at the very early stage here, I've been here for 6 months. So, you know, there is a team. We're doing, you know, a bunch of stuff. We are on the phase of designing our strategy and so on. So we were, you know, we're working, you know, between now and Qatar 2022 and a lot of stuff that we have.
So are we talking, let's say, structures, processes? So what makes up, or let's say, trying to modernize, digitalize the let's say core component or body of the organization,
no,
or are we really
talking about? I think it's a very different level.
Okay.
So it's kind of, you know, in a deal world, all of this.
Yeah.
But, you know, we need to start with small steps. You know, so, you know, first of all, you know, how can we really leverage technology and innovate? Yes, sure. At the process level, but also, you know, at the fan experience level, how can we best engage with, you know, with fans and be really the umbrella brand of football around the world. So first step, you know, what do we know about our fans, you know?
So right, that is now, do you have a concrete
so
example?
A whole, for instance, you know, we're trying to build the fan relationship management system, which is the key, again, you know, data as the key of, you know, how to build, you know, a sustainable business and also a relationship that is meaningful with your fans. You know, this is, you know, the example I can't talk about many things so this right now, but, you know, I'll just give you this example to, again, data as a central piece, you know, how you actually go about to change also the mindset and create something new. And that's probably one of the, you know, also, I'm not talking about, this is also, if you read the FIFA 2.0 guidelines, you know, the fan relationship platform is one of the core pillars of, you know, the things they want to build in the future. But yeah, and still has to deal with data. So if you want to go back at the beginning, the only red thread that there is my crazy going all over the place is probably data. That's the constant that you can find everywhere. Yeah, and here, you know, there's the same challenges in a way before, you know, the human part, you know, the traditional, you know, organizational cultural change. But actually, that's, again, the reason why this, you know, division has been created. And so, again, I think we are up for the challenge. So, yeah, we're...
So it's more going into, let's say, really the value proposition, right?
Yes.
So really in this, the product, services.
And also, product, services, you know, and again, the centrality of fans, rather,
right,
you know.
Okay.
So this is one of the pillars we're working
right now. So how would you describe FIFA as an organization? I mean, like, it's really it's not usual usual to work for
I think it's really interesting to get insights from a person working here.
Yeah, again, you know, I think, you know, it has, honestly, I don't find it, there are the same, most of the same things that you find in other organizations. So I think, you know, there's a lot of, even, you know, not that different from, you know, what I found in Pirelli or, you know, even in other organization, you know. It's a organization that comes together when, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, like, for instance, on the big events that we do is a really great coming together and working on common purpose. You know, then, you know, we suffer a little bit of the usual fragmentation that you can see in every company. Sometimes, you know, we work in silos. Part of our, you know, team effort is to build cross-functional working group, bring people together, and again, use technology to facilitate this. I don't think there is a, you know, many differences, honestly. Although, you know, it's a non-for-profit per se, so, you know, you don't have, you know, the quarterly call or the, you know, there's a different maybe pressure on the kind of, you know, deadline that if you work on a listed company, but you face the same, you know, kind of the same, I would say, pattern and challenges. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then, you know, the underlying passion for football that everybody has, so it makes it look like really driven.
So you are passionate about football?
Yeah, you know, I'm more passionate about technology. And one of the reasons I'm here, you know, that's, you know, one of the, again, really criteria that, you know, part of this organization, purposely didn't want just to have people coming from the sport world. Mm-hmm. In fact, in my team were people coming from Amazon, coming from, you know, in our division, people coming from Swarovski, from Fox. So from a different, that's the actually great mm-hmm. thing, you know, because otherwise if you want to change mindset and you bring in people that always been working in the same industry, you're already kind of, you know, confined in the same mindset. Instead, you know, also the great idea is to bring people from other industry, other business, you know, to
yeah, it was also to bring different perspectives. Team at Tesla,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, with exactly. Yeah, but even yeah, people with different background, but you know, exactly. But here, the whole division, you know, is gathering people that are not necessarily and actually purposely not coming from the not for football, but even sometimes not from sports, like me. You know, I have different many people in our, and that's a great thing, mm-hmm. I think, because you know, you need really to see things with the. Kind of a fresh eyes if when it comes to, you know, steering and changing an organization. So, yeah.
All right. I think it will be interesting. We were still, I think we have a couple of minutes left. Before we get into our last question, we have one question.
Oh, boy, I don't... That's going to be the hard one. I'm not looking forward for that last question, which is going to be tough.
No, we always ask the same question at the end.
Okay, and then you grade
guests.
Us.
No, we don't grade you.
Don't make it public.
No, it's not. So I just want... because you've been involved within, let's say, the... within the tech world for mm-hmm. quite some years, especially within the, let's say, more or less say data-driven technologies. Mm-hmm. What are trends that you see? What are certain things within, let's say, within machine learning, within whatever, narrow AI?
What is underestimated?
Yeah.
I think, as I said, what is underestimated is the need of building the proper decision-making process and space and what I call it, you know, argumentative spaces around mm-hmm. machine learning. This is completely underestimated. There is either in terms of, you know, actual decision-making process, how do we work it, either in terms of skills that are needed when both of, you know, management and data scientists, you know, to really deal with the challenges that, you know, current models and solutions are facing. This is the most underestimated. The overestimated is, you know, that, you know, the idea that that data is always, that data is the truth and that's enough, which is, you know, is an effect or a cause of the underestimation of the other aspect, you know, mm-hmm. that, so it's a kind of a blind faith. And also that the idea, a little bit of a hubris, the idea, you know, okay, this is the data, there's no need to discuss about it. Instead, no. For me, data or an outcome of a model is where the interesting part of the discussion, the arguing starts, is not the ending point. So again, I maybe focus more on this kind of soft or, you know, decisional or cultural problems, but I think these are the most important because the trend is, honestly, data scientists, guys, you know, maybe... The work that I've been doing since 2012, the work of the scientist has changed completely. We were spending time tweaking cleaning data is kind of the same, let's say, but you know, the future, the trend that you see, you're going to throw the right data to, you know, the sage maker or whatever the sage maker in the future. You don't have to tweak the models anymore. You got to have the answer. You just need to understand the problem, find the right data in, frame the problem correctly, and explain the answer. Mm-hmm. This is going to be more and more the job of a data scientist rather than, you know, the hardcore technical, in my opinion, is going to be more and more, you know, framing the right problem, explaining the solution, you know, and find the right data and the right question to be solved. And this, honestly, is less and less technical and more, if you want to say, business, or call it, you know, social and cultural, going back to what I see. So the trend that I see that, you know, that you know, self-serving machine learning on AI is going to rise a lot, mm-hmm. you know. And so the skill set, you know, what is a data scientist in this context is going to shift a little bit. And it's more and more the ability of getting the right data, posing the right question and explaining the answer. And this, for me, requires, as I said, you know, a lot of skills in a different context in how we debate and we take decision at the moment around machine learning AI in every organization. Yeah, probably that. You know, sorry, you may expect some more. Like, no, actually, yeah, I believe that.
It's actually
recurrent neural network are gonna be the best, or you know, no, like it's actually adversary. Yeah, but this is really, I think, is one of the main thing that I see.
So you really think that it's more or less going to be like kind of machine learning as a service type of way?
More
so
and more, yes. Doesn't mean that you don't have to understand, you know, and know what a model does, what are the basics, you know, of course you do. But, you know, but the way in which you interact, you know, from, you know, building from scratch, trying, all this part is going to go away.
Okay.
And more is going to be important, you know, exactly what is the data you choose to answer the problem, you know, and what is the problem?
To be able to interpret,
and how do you explain, the outcome, and how you get the buy-in to all this great thing that you've done is coming and is put in production, and how do you assess the impact and risks of it? What is the process? Where is the space? How does it look like in a company? The actual social space where we debate these things. There's no much of a thing right now. It's either random, or is it a blind faith, or is it, oh, no, it's too risky, I don't understand it. So we need to build the in-betweenness of these two extremes, because otherwise we're all going to pay for the consequences, be it like too much or too little, you know, that doesn't matter, but yeah.
True. All right, that was already quite interesting. Thanks for that. I think we're coming to our last question now.
Oh, dear. That's the hard one.
Because we believe that the people that are shaping the future are the ones who are who can predict it best. We always ask for one prediction in the end.
Boy.
It's completely free to you. Mm-hmm. Which time frame you set yourself and which field you choose. Just tell us something that you strongly believe will happen in the future.
I strongly believe it's a kind of can it be between a belief and a hope? So I strongly believe and hope that a common framework for dealing on how we share and use our personal data has to be built. Mm-hmm. I do believe, I mean, privacy and, you know, personal data and how do we deal with all this is going to be one of the main mm-hmm. issues that we have to face, and we have to find a solution. I strongly believe that there is all the technical capabilities to put the user in control of their data, but also, you know, not just to prevent something, but also to allow them to do something. Mm-hmm. I want to give my old genome sequence for research. How can I do that? I want to do this part to you and this part to him. I mean, we have the technology to do that. And I want to be rewarded for this or not, or I want to give you the capability to see what I'm watching right now. I mean, about being in control, you know what I mean? So for me, in the future, we're going to see a lot of effort in this space because we need to grant and build solution for people to allow to control what they want to share, how they want to share, and be rewarded even for that. So that's, 10 years from now, don't make me listen to this again. But as I said, though, it's between a belief and a hope. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. I think that as well. I guess, especially for us here in Europe, I think that is something where, we kind of, I think, can, strive, you know, because I believe, like, especially if you look at China or if you look at,
US,
right?
Yeah, different.
It's just about, okay, convenience and building or growth. Let's say growth, growth first, the convenience and money, probably. And,
but we've seen already consequences, right? So, that will push, you know, we see even in, anyway, we no, I just want to talk, you know, I don't want to talk big company names. But anyway, so I think we're going to see more and more solutions in this direction. And again, I hope. I hope to see more and more, but I think we will.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Carlo.
Thank you, guys. And yeah.